or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now here's your host, Ward Morrow.
Today we'll be joined by AFGE National Secretary Treasurer J. David Cox, Council of Prison Locals Legislative Coordinator Phil Glover, National Fair Practices Coordinator Mike Castile, and Vietnam Veterans of America National President John Rowan. Welcome to Inside Government.
Good morning, Ward. How are you today?
John Rowan, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good morning, Ward. How are you?
Good morning. John, start off by telling us a little about the Vietnam Veterans of America organization and the Veterans Health Council.
Sure. Vietnam Veterans of America is a national organization. We're chartered by Congress, and we've been around for a little over 30 years. And obviously, we got started by a bunch of Vietnam veterans coming together. And we're a service organization. We help veterans in any way we can. A lot of our efforts involve in lobbying down on the Hill. And so we work very closely with AFGE and a lot of the other unions. And Jay David's a good friend. As far as the Veterans Health Council, this is something we started about 2 years ago now, I guess, and really been up and running about a year, where we brought people together from all facets of the healthcare community, academics, advocate groups, the unions, some of the pharmaceutical companies, even some of the healthcare companies, to talk about the issues of veterans' health. It really started with the problems faced by Vietnam veterans with Agent Orange, and exposure to what is commonly known as Agent Orange, but really is dioxin and a whole series of other toxic chemicals that we use to defoliate the areas around base camps and in various parts of Vietnam, which unfortunately have had severe side effects over that have really shown up, especially later on in life, with some very severe cancers and other kinds of problems and diabetes and a whole host of diseases. And unfortunately, our toxic exposure was very similar to things that have gone on with some of the Persian Gulf vets and even some of the new vets. Different issues, different exposures, but the same general problem, long-term healthcare problems. So we brought all these people together to talk about it and to educate the healthcare community, because the one thing people don't understand is that 75% of the veterans in this country don't use the VA. They're in the private healthcare sector. Unfortunately, nobody ever asked them the question, are you a veteran, and don't understand what time service means to some of these folks and their health issues. So that's what both of us are about.
And, Jay David, let me ask you a little about AFG's participation in this.
AFG has strongly supported the Veterans Health Council, and AFG has been a longtime friend of Vietnam veterans, and they've certainly been a true friend of AFGE and most of all of the veterans of this country. And John, I want to take a point of personal privilege here and thank you and the Vietnam Veterans of America. Y'all have supported very strongly the Vietnam-era veterans, but you've supported World War II. You've supported the Iraq, Afghanistan, Persian Gulf. If the person is a veteran, Vietnam Veterans of America has been out there blazing the trails and working and giving 100% to those veterans. And that's a real important thing. That, you know, you're not just focused on your particular group. If they're a veteran, VVA is out there fighting every day for their rights and to provide a care and service. And I would talk a little bit about the VA. The VA is the best healthcare system in this country. The absolute. It's rated over and over. It wasn't always that way, but for years now, the VA is rated as the number one healthcare system. It should be the healthcare system that veterans want to go to. Veterans serve this country very loyally, and they have an absolute right to receive their health care and treatment at the VA. And I believe Veterans Health Council is trying to make the veteran population very much aware of that, as well as the fact trying to educate healthcare providers throughout the country that many of the illnesses and signs and symptoms that patients present themselves that are veterans, that it may be related to their service in the military.
And John, let me ask you a little about PTSD. I know that's gotten some prominence because of the activity that people from the Vietnam era brought out, but it's not new to Vietnam era veterans. I mean, it's been around for a long time, but maybe nobody gave it the requisite amount of attention. Let's talk about what the government's doing, issuing new rules to make it easier for veterans on this.
Yes. They're coming out today, or yesterday. I think the final rule finally came out. Post-traumatic stress disorder, frankly, is the formal name given to really the result of anyone, frankly, whether in the military or not, who's gone through a traumatic experience and often manifest themselves with kinds of other issues as they go forward in life. And sometimes these things, these traumatic events come back to haunt them, particularly later on in life. It's really amazing to me that we're finding a lot of Vietnam veterans now, as they retire, things that they kind of shoved in the corner 40 years ago and, put aside are coming back to haunt them. And these problems are not new to us. I mean, this has always been going back probably as long as there have been people fighting each other, that they've had this issue. It's just that during the Vietnam and after the Vietnam War, the work that was done by various psychologists and psychiatrists with Vietnam veterans helped to codify the whole issue of post-traumatic stress disorder. And now, with the new wars going on, unfortunately, a lot of these veterans are really being exposed to horrendous things that are causing them problems. And what they've come to realize, it's not just the man or woman out there in the field with a gun getting shot at or shooting at others that are traumatized. And they finally come to understand that the truck driver riding through a dangerous area where there's explosions going on and people are shooting at them is just as much exposed to traumatic events as the infantryman in the field. And so they started to the new rule hopefully will allow Vietnam veterans even, and this certainly newer veterans, to go back and be able to file claims if they've been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, to show that as long as they were in a combat zone, in a combat area, that was a good reason to understand that they would have been traumatized without having to specify some specific event. I mean, even those of us who were in the rear, and I was a lucky guy, I was an intel guy, but, those of us back in Da Nang, we were rocketed, we were bombed, we had all kinds of things going on. And so all those folks are just as exposed to traumatic events as much as the folks in the field. And so the VA understands that now, finally. And with the new rule put out by Secretary Shinseki, I think we're going to have a lot more justice in this world for veterans coming home who need some help.
And, J. David, let me ask you, from the perspective of the folks that work at the VA, are these new rules going to make it easier to get that backlog down? I know that's been a concern for AFG for a long time.
I think that it would clearly help with reducing the backlog. Again, as John pointed out, the veterans in the past have had to have a specific occasion that could have caused PTSD. And I mean, it's PTSD can be any way. It happens to people all the time. You take children that are maybe raised in an abusive home or something like that. I mean, how do you point to a specific event that created the trauma that you've experienced? The same thing with a veteran. It's a way to reduce the backlog. They were in combat. You know they were in combat areas. You know that they it was a chaotic life. Any of us, if we lived in an environment where someone is constantly shooting, bombing, that your life is in constant threat and danger, that's trauma to anyone. I mean, it has to be.
Now, John, let me also ask you a little about the new decisions that are coming out in terms of Agent Orange and new diseases being added to the list of concerns. Tell us a little about that.
Yes. Back in 91 or 92 or so, they finally created a law that allows a scientific review of diseases caused by or related to Agent Orange and other toxic exposures. And they've allowed the Institute of Medicine to do these studies. And when they come up and make pronouncements that there are certain diseases that they believe are correlated to Agent Orange exposure, the VA in turn reviews them and then can put them on the list of presumptive diseases which enables any veteran who served in Vietnam that has that particular illness or ailment to be able to come in and say, look, I served in Vietnam, I had this ailment, it was because of Agent Orange exposure. This entitles them to compensation and entitles them to health care. And so over the years, many illnesses have been added. Unfortunately, it's a fairly substantial list, predominantly cancers, particularly one of the major ones being prostate cancer and lung cancer, but also diabetes. Recently, there have been three new diseases that the IOM came up with. One is Parkinson's, one is B-cell leukemia, and the third is ischemic heart conditions, which is going to involve a substantial number of veterans. And so when the final rules come down on these three diseases, they will be added to the list of presumptive diseases that have been entitled veterans, Vietnam veterans, and veterans who served along the DMZ in Korea, the demilitarized zone in Korea. And we believe in various other areas that expose them to Agent Orange as well. There's a lot of places in the world that we used Agent Orange, unfortunately, particularly in Thailand. And there were people in Guam and some other little islands that had been where the stuff got transported through and stored. So it's going to open the door, frankly, for a lot more veterans to get their health care. And as Jay David pointed out, that thanks to the AFGE members, the VA is now the best place to go for health care. And so we really try to get as many veterans in there as we can.
As I come down to the last minute of this segment, let me ask you, if you're a veteran, let's say, that's out there that has diabetes or prostate cancer, you were in Vietnam, but let's say maybe you were on a ship, you weren't actually in the field, but right. The ship was transporting things, you were in the zone. Do the new rules then make it easier for somebody in that situation to file?
Not yet. We are working very closely with the VA to identify those ships who actually came into shore. And we're also fighting through the Congress and to get those other Blue Water Navy, as they call them, ships included, because one of the things the Australians have done a lot of study on is the use of desalinated water, unfortunately, made the concentration of the dioxin even higher. And so even those ships that were so-called out at sea were often utilizing desalinated water that got polluted because of the Agent Orange runoff. I mean, that's one of the things that's very clear. It's not just the fact that somebody got sprayed on. It's all this runoff of water and other ways that things, that the ground and the air and the water gets polluted.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances. Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. Purchase any laptop from July 15th through August 15th and receive a free custom skin. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
AFGE members are eligible for a 6% members only discount.
Have you been to AFGE's new online store? Members and activists can now purchase AFGE items online using a credit card and have them conveniently shipped right to your door. Visit the store at www.afgestore.org. You'll be able to buy all the hottest AFGE products, from hats and watches to coffee mugs and pens, plus the famous Inside Government t-shirts. That's more than 70 items to choose from. Start shopping today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with AFGE National Secretary Treasurer J. David Cox and also Vietnam Veterans of America National President John Rowan. So we were talking a little bit about Agent Orange and how veterans can maybe recognize this problem. John, what are the types of things veterans should be on the lookout for?
Well, they really should go. We have a website called veteranshealth.org. We really encourage any veteran from Vietnam forward to go to that website to look at the various diseases that are associated with their military service and to familiarize themselves with them just in case, unfortunately, they get diagnosed by anything either directly associated with that list or somewhat akin to anything on that list. And so that's really the best thing we can tell them. Unfortunately, particularly with the Vietnam vets, the list has gotten so long now, it's pretty hard to just say, go check out this or that. But unfortunately, so some of the substantial cancers are very clear. Prostate cancer is way off the charts. And strangely enough, diabetes has been a big factor. When they were looking into this and doing the research, they were looking at the cancers and accidentally found the diabetes. The rates of diabetes amongst Vietnam veterans is extremely high.
So if they find that they've maybe got some of these situations, can they contact your organization to help them fill out the paperwork?
Absolutely. They can call us, or if we're not available in their area, I encourage them to call a state or county veteran service agencies. They're very helpful to help them file a claim. One thing about the VA, it's never too late to file a claim. Even 40 years later or 50 years later, I filed claims for World War II veterans when I was doing that kind of work a couple of years ago. So it's never too late, and I encourage anybody who thinks they may have a claim to please go and file. Unfortunately, a lot of people have not done that, and they really should. And even people who had gotten earlier disabilities, one of the things that they may have gotten hurt in the service and they got a small disability. And unfortunately, as you age, things get worse. And they need to take that into consideration and go back for a reevaluation, that perhaps things have gotten worse. And then the diabetic people, for example, one of the things about diabetes is it leads to all kinds of other conditions. So, for example, I myself am a 90% disabled veteran, primarily because of diabetes, but mostly because of my secondary condition, which is neuropathy. So diabetics get neuropathy in their feet and their hands. They have eye problems. They have all kinds of other ancillary problems related to their diabetes, and those are covered as well. So we really encourage veterans to go to the website, go to veteranshealth.org, and get as much information as they can, and bring it to their doctors. That's the one key thing. We're trying to educate the medical field as well.
Now, let me change up a little bit and ask you about your organization and what they're doing on Capitol Hill. What's your legislative agenda?
Well, our main legislative agenda for several years had been to get the full funding for the VA, which, frankly, we succeeded on. The veterans organizations were very united on that. And I think that we actually did very well with the VA budget. And I think Jay David would agree that the VA has got a substantial amount of money now. The question we have is what they're doing with that money. So we're really looking to Congress to do oversight and how this funding is being implemented out at the hospital level and the outpatient level. We're also, Frank, quite honestly, somewhat concerned recently about some of these things that we've seen in the paper with some poor practices that have gone on inside some of the VAs, and we're concerned about that as well. We're also, that Blue Water Navy issue you mentioned earlier, trying to include them as far as the exposure to Agent Orange is another big issue for us. And, of course, for the newer veterans, we're very much concerned to ensure that they get all the health care that they're entitled to. And given the fact that we know so much now about post-traumatic stress disorder, there's no excuse that any veteran out there who has any sort of issues with PTSD should be able to get the services they need in their area. The VA's got a lot of vet centers all across the country who are doing wonderful work, and we really encourage the younger veterans to utilize the VA.
And let me ask you one more question about your organization. When you all first got formed, was there a feeling amongst Vietnam veterans that there was some unmet needs that maybe some of the other groups weren't really handling? We've had some other people kind of come on and talk about what it's been like to be a Vietnam veteran. Describe what that situation was, if you can.
Yeah, unfortunately, I actually attributed somewhat to a generation gap that went on. Truthfully, our predecessors were not very good about dealing with psychological issues, for example. And they really had a hard time dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder or understanding what that meant, even though many of them had it. That was one problem. In the early days of Agent Orange, the VA was very vehement in saying, no, it didn't have anything to do with anything. No, it was fine. And it really was a real battle. And finally, some of the other older organizations did come around. And now, of course, we're all standing united on these issues. But it was a struggle in the beginning. And it was, frankly, one of the reasons why Vietnam Veterans of America was created.
Now, Jay David, let's talk a little again about the great care that veterans receive at the VA. How important is it for the veterans to take full advantage of all these services?
Oh, it's absolutely. It's imperative that veterans take advantage of every service at the VA. And also the fact that the VA is specialized for veterans health care. As John has talked about on several occasions, I mean, where else do you treat people from diseases relating to Agent Orange except in the VA? I mean, that is a unique situation. That's not a general population event that occurs. And the VA is specialized health care. The needs of veteran has a very unique flavor to it. And some of the things that we've worked with Vietnam veterans and many of the veterans organizations is maintaining the VA health care system. There's been a move several times to try to contract out care, and AFGE and all other organizations realize if you are in the middle of let's say Montana or something, you may be hundreds of miles away from a VA medical center, but there's been a real move to establish clinics or either to develop relationship with private practitioners. But the real issue should be that should be the exception, not the rule. The bulk of our country, there are VA medical centers and in close proximity to most veterans. We should be building more VA medical centers as well as expanding our outpatient clinics and vet centers and areas to meet the needs of the veterans.
And obviously having the conflicts in the Middle East, and for as long as they've gone on, and the tens of thousands of people have been involved, how do the services at the VA, how do you think they're going to help them sort of deal with the long-term illnesses and homelessness that that population is going to need help with?
I think the VA is well prepared to meet those needs, to care for those veterans. And again, we are talking about post-traumatic stress. We are talking about mental illness, and our country has struggled with mental illness through the years, from where we chose at one time to warehouse people with mental illness, to ignore them and put them out of facilities, to now to treat people and accept it and understand it, that it's an illness like any other illness, and that folks need specialized care and to meet those needs of those individuals. And the VA is the one that's well equipped to do that. And the VA, the healthcare system, many of its facilities are aging. There is a need to replace those facilities. And again, not to contract them out or to dismantle them. I know Vietnam veterans has worked with AFGE. There's been attempts at times to basically just have a floor inside of a university medical center that was for veterans and get rid of a VA medical center. And none of us support those type things. It's specialized health care that has to exist. And as long as we have a country and as long as there is conflict in the world, we will have veterans. And when those folks raise their hand, serve this country, every man and woman, and receive an honorable discharge, I personally believe they paid their health insurance premiums in full for the rest of their life. And if they are suffering disabilities, we as a country have a responsibility to meet those disability needs and provide resources for that veteran as long as they live.
And let's talk also a little about some recent things going on at the VA. AFGE has been greatly increasing its membership. Tell us a little about that.
Part of it, I would go back to what John has said. The VA has received increased funding, and the VA has been increasing its staffing. But also, I think the VA employees have realized the work that AFGE has been doing on Capitol Hill for them as employees and for the VA healthcare system. We worked very hard with all of the veterans organizations for the advanced appropriations of the funding of the VA. That was a long-time goal of us and everyone involved in the veteran community, and we were successful in that. I believe the employees are excited about the work that they're doing in the VA and realize that AFGE is out there blazing the trails to increase the staffing, to increase the technology, and all the things necessary to provide great quality health care for veterans.
And John, as we come down to our last minute, let me ask you about the future agenda for your organization. Obviously, with the baby boomers getting older, is your organization starting to look at geriatric services for veterans? Because it seems like that would be very different than sort of regular geriatrics.
Oh, yeah, very much so. I mean, we've gotten some bills passed that have helped with home care to help those veterans be able to stay at home instead of having to be put in a nursing home. Very clearly, we're starting to age out, the Vietnam veterans. And, you know, veterans aren't disappearing. They talk about, oh, the World War II and the Korean veterans, oh, they're all dying off. Well, that is true, but they're being replaced in the geriatric community by the Vietnam veterans, frankly. And we're still a fairly good number of folk hanging around out there. And we're going to be around for hopefully several more years. And, yes, it is an issue for us. We are concerned about that. We think the VA needs to expand its nursing home beds in various places around the country. It needs to expand its geriatric care.
And we're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Michael Castile, National Fair Practices Coordinator, AFGE Council of Prisons Locals. Welcome to Inside Government.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's talk a little about the Bureau of Prisons. It's facing, obviously, staffing and funding shortages and has for years, but there's also issues related to discrimination and equal employment opportunities. Tell us a little about that.
Well, in the Federal Bureau of Prisons right now, one of the things that's a problem is the Friend of Vesting program, which is a precautionary program prior to the EE process, is not doing what it's supposed to do. In other words, there are many barriers in the Bureau of Prisons, such as hiring minorities, hiring people with special disabilities in the Bureau of Prisons. None of those issues are being addressed, so those barriers remain. And then the EEO process is broken down because a lot of times the collaborative duty EEO counselors work for the same people that allegedly have been discriminated against other individuals. So it's problematic.
Now, is this really an agency-wide problem, or are there certain specific situations, and I know you can't get into too much specifics, but are certain facilities more difficult to deal with than others, or is it agency-wide?
Well, I think it's more facilities are difficult than others, and it's we have a lot more minorities. The institution that hire more minorities, particularly the institution that has more problems.
And where would be some, give us an example of what would be more problematic versus some that are less problematic and why?
Let's say, for example, like Federal Corrections Institution Petersburg, because they have a lot of minority staff, a lot of black staff. There's a problem with discrimination, and as opposed to maybe some locals in the Northeast that may have less of an issue of discrimination, but they have less minorities.
Now, how has the Bureau of Prisons Management responded to these problems?
Well, I tell you what, I must give them credit. They met me halfway. One of the issues that we had was the collaborative duty EEO counselors was working for the wardens in the facilities, and they was looking out for their own careers in the EEO process. So a lot of times, that was a breakdown right there. So what the Bureau has decided to do was create full-time EEO counselors, take it out the hands of the wardens, and have them directly responsible to the central office in the EEO officer. I think that's going to alleviate some of the problem also.
And so they've been willing to work with you, and would you say there's been a backlog of cases and they've been dealt with better recently, or has this been a historical problem? For how many years? How long have you been doing this? Let me start there.
I've been a National Fair Practice Coordinator for the Bureau of Prisons for the last 10 years, and we have just gotten together recently. I've been talking about this with the agency for 10 years. However, recently they've given me more attention and they've addressed that issue with me. So I give them credit for that. However, the affirmative action program in the Bureau is very much broken, and I think that needs to be fixed.
And what kinds of things do you think would help fix it? What sort of things would you be looking for?
One of the things I would like to see them do is talk about barriers of discrimination. What's creating, what's holding people back from upper mobility, and what's creating discriminatory work practices in the workplace? Those conversations need to be held in the Affirmative Action Committee meetings, which I schedule monthly. And if we could discuss those things without getting our personal feelings involved, I think we could resolve a lot of issues before we get to the formal process of filing an EEO complaint.
And does the agency do a lot? And it seems like a lot of federal agencies over the past maybe 20, 30 years have stopped doing this. But it used to be something in terms of EEO where you had some leeway in agencies to help pay for classes for people to get degrees or get certifications, get additional training, which helps folks move up and it helps all folks move up, quite frankly. Do you think that kind of training process and program would be helpful?
I think it'd be very helpful. I think a lot of managers, before we get in that managerial role, would go through these diversity classes and other classes to deal with different minority groups and to learn really the culture of different people. It would be very helpful when they come to supervise these individuals.
And do you think that you represent a lot of the folks, talk to a lot of the folks. Are people sort of clamoring for that? Do you think that you know our folks would want that?
Yes. Listen, everybody, I don't care who you are. You want to work in a workplace that's fair and equitable and that you have the same opportunity as anybody else to advancement. We all want that. And I think if we can get an atmosphere like that in the Bureau of Prisons, it'll be a pleasant place to work in. Unfortunately, we have some people with the do-as-I-say mentality, and they don't care nothing about your rights, and that will cause a lot of problems. And then they misinterpret some things that employees do. Like some employees, based on their culture, when they speak with their hands, and it might be somewhat boisterous in some people's opinion, but in their culture, that's just regular conversation. And you might misconstrue that as the employees being disruptive. And actually, in all actuality, it's not. And I think if you were to have cultural classes, you will learn things like that and learn how to deal with people like that.
Now let's talk a little about the council's master agreement with the Bureau of Prisons. Does it deal specifically with EEO issues?
Yes, we have certain articles that deal specifically with EEO and affirmative action.
And can you tell us a little about that language?
Well, one of our articles, we have that the Affirmative Action Committee will be a sounding board for any individual to discuss discriminatory practices. However, that's not being adhered to in the agency, unfortunately. And it talks about creating a fair and equitable working environment for all individuals, which we are working better towards now in recent times than in the past.
Do you think sometimes in doing this that there are situations that maybe end up in an EEO situation, but as you're kind of talking about, maybe like cultural differences and things like that that could be dealt with outside of the grievance process, outside of the EEO process?
I think that, yes, I would agree with that. I think some issues are like that. Some issues are just different cultural issues, and I think they could be better handled outside of the EEO process if given the opportunity.
Or even just personality differences. I mean, you might even have two people that are from, you know, a similar cultural background, but just for whatever reason, whether it's Bureau of Prisons or anywhere, and I guess in your 10 years of doing fair practices, whether you've seen situations that there may be a need for some other mechanism for handling this or having a discussion. And I'm thinking like these labor management forums that are going on agency-wide in some agencies. Maybe if you had a facility-wide situation like that where people got together and talked, that would be helpful.
I would love to see that. I think that's a great idea, and I think if you were to see more of that, I think a lot of issues will be resolved, and a lot better understanding will become between a lot of individuals. Because if you get an opportunity to speak in a setting that's non-combative, a lot of times you get a lot of issues resolved.
Let me also ask you, are there any specific discrimination cases that you're comfortable sharing with us now, maybe that have been resolved, without giving us names or anything, but give us an idea of what kinds of problems come up and how they get resolved?
Well, right now we have a class action in the Bureau of Prisons in regards to those people participating in the EEO process receiving reprisals from the Federal Bureau of Prisons because they participated in the process, and that's agency-wide, and that's ongoing as we speak right now. And there's been a situation I know I was personally involved in where a lot of negative, this young lady was put in for a job for a promotion, and she was denied based on her race. and it was a lot of negative racial innuendos being posted in the institution and being stated to her from supervisors. And we won a decision for her for a promotion and back plate, plus $35,000 liquidated damages. So, and that goes on in the Bureau all the time.
And are there some other different kinds of cases?
Yeah, there are numerous cases. But, you know, the biggest problem is, even though a person win a case, there's no accountability. In other words, even though a third party has found the agency or supervisor guilty of discrimination, there is no disciplinary practice or no corrective action to the manager. And there are cases of promotions. There's cases. I mean, they're so numerous, it's hard to narrow a lot of them down.
Well, let's talk also about when you work in the Bureau of Prisons, and I mean, I've worked in a prison myself. It's a different kind of work situation than you have in a lot of other places. I mean, when you're dealing with the inmates that you're dealing with in a federal correctional institution, I mean, that sets up a certain level of, I guess, confrontation that you don't have in other workplaces. And then that carries out, I guess, into the labor management field because it's a place where you're likely to have confrontation. Would that be correct?
That would be absolutely correct. I think when you're working in the Bureau of Prisons, you have an eight personality, and you're very, forward-thinking. You're somewhat aggressive because you have to have the type of attitude, the type of personality, and all the functions in the prison setting. So we have so much of a can-do demeanor, and we don't accept no for an answer. And we're going to make it happen. And I think that's just anybody working in the prison. So, I think people outside the prison setting may think of that being aggressive, but to us, that's the norm.
Well, and I would think if you're going to have people that are managers, as you mentioned, some specialized training in dealing with that. I mean, if you're a correctional officer, you're probably not a wallflower. And
right.
So when you're managing folks that, you know, are need to be tough, managing that can be, you know, a difficult situation, and you've got to deal with those folks in a professional manner. Do you think maybe more training for managers would be helpful?
Yeah. You know, and because of the Bureau of Prisons, the turnover is great because you retire young in the Bureau of Prisons. After 57, it's mandatory. And we're growing exponentially because people have been locked up all over the place. I mean, so we got a lot of young managers. And I think if we were to train these managers to, and you're right, to deal with different personalities and deal with this kind of somewhat aggressive behavior, that we could come to an understanding in the field. And I think everything that what is needed is just a dialogue, an open dialogue, an open forum, so we can discuss these issues rationally as adults and then professionally. And I think it'll do a world of good for everybody.
And as we come down to our last 2 minutes in this segment, let's talk about the differences between, you say you've been doing this for 10 years.
Yes.
And I know a lot of people have been talking about it. The change in atmosphere over the last couple of years. Describe that for me, what it was like maybe 4 or 5 years ago versus what it's like today, and what specifically is being done differently.
Well, I think 4 or 5 or several years ago, beyond which you, as an employer, you had no rights that management needed to respect. I mean, those mechanisms that was in place in order to make a fair and equitable workplace, they was being ignored. Here recently, I think now that our rights are being respected again, and those mechanisms put in place to ensure a fair and equitable working environment are now doing what they're supposed to do. And I think that's changing in the whole climate of the workplace. I think we're getting along a little bit better now because our rights are being respected. And now I think that we have a voice. Somebody's listening. So that's always a great thing.
And how many folks are there that do fair practices and EEO work for AFGE in the Bureau of Prisons?
Well, they have a whole department, and I think the agency might have, AFG might have about 20, a staff of 20 people, several attorneys, several EEO specialists. I mean, they're very effective, and they do a lot of work for, I know they help the Bureau out tremendously on a lot of different occasions. And myself personally, we have 6 regional fair practice coordinators and numerous institutional coordinators, and we're getting a lot better, to be honest with you.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Are you an AFGE member who loves the great outdoors? Then the AFGE Union Sportsmen's Alliance benefit is perfect for you. Whether it's fins, furs, or feathers that calls you, the Union Sportsmen's Alliance has you covered. This unique benefit is a community of hunters and fishermen who share the Union Brotherhood. That's right, an exclusive hunting and fishing club by and for Union members, retirees, and their families. Your $25 membership gets you money-saving discounts on great outdoor gear and services, a free MyTopo.com online mapping subscription, a one-year subscription to a top outdoor magazine, and a $25 gift certificate for Beretta field gear. You'll also receive a subscription to the Union Sportsman's Journal. To learn more about this exciting benefit, please visit the member benefits page at afge.org or call us at 877-872-2211. That's 877-872-2211. Join today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Phil Glover, the Legislative Coordinator for the Council of Prisons Locals. Welcome back to Inside Government.
Thank you.
So let's talk. We've been talking about the Bureau of Prisons, and recently announced it was going to eliminate the UniCorps services at 9 facilities. Is that right?
Yes. We got notified yesterday by letter that the Bureau will be closing a number of facilities in prison industries, and they will be downsizing at other facilities.
And why is this?
Well, this is a long story. It goes back to 2004 when the National Defense Authorization Act was done. Senator Carl Levin and others changed the contracting rules for prison industry programs. And over the years, we have lost a lot of Department of Defense contracts and business. And also with the war winding down in Iraq, that also has taken some of the business away from the program. And so the result of that is that program is self-sustaining. We have to do sales to other government agencies, and that's who pays the staff and who pays the inmates. It's a non-appropriated fund operation. So this will be pretty devastating for a lot of people in a lot of areas across the country.
Now, a lot of people may not know exactly what UniCorps is. And you know, when you look historically back at prisons, people kind of have seen movies and you hear about the chain gangs and that sort of thing. What exactly is UniCorps?
Well, what UniCorps is that's the trade name that the Bureau of Prisons came up with years ago. It's really a inmate work program called Federal Prison Industries. And that program was created in 1934 by then President Roosevelt, during the Great Depression, as a matter of fact, to get a handle on inmate labor. At that time, inmates, wardens out in the countryside would set up little side deals with towns and other things to use inmate labor, sometimes in inappropriate ways. And so it was codified into law in 1934 as a prison industries program for the federal prison system.
And is it a government-run program or is it a private industry program? Who's in charge?
Well, who's in charge is the Federal Bureau of Prisons has a board of directors that are appointed by the President of the United States. And those board of directors come from different parts of the public sector and private sector. And then the actual CEO of the organization is technically the director of the Bureau of Prisons, but we have an assistant director of the Bureau of Prisons that runs the program on a daily basis. And then we actually have a public board that oversees the program.
And what kind of things do the inmates do when they're involved in the UniCorps program?
Well, the prison industries program produces goods and services for the federal government in general. Electric cables, textiles. We used to be large in furniture manufacturing for government agencies, but that has dwindled over the years because of these contracting changes that were done in 2004 and by Senator Levin. And at this point, the last 2 years have been extremely difficult. But the inmates, some inmates make signage for the federal government. We have some print operations that used to make GPO government calendars, those kind of things. Those were done by inmates. And the program taught inmates not maybe a marketable skill in their local area, but it taught inmates how to work with other people, and it taught inmates how to get up and go to work every day and work for a supervisor, which many of these inmates don't have those skills when they come to federal prison.
And how many positions do you think we're going to lose out of this?
Well, the initial estimate at this point is, as of yesterday, the numbers that the union was given, we are looking at 140 staff positions across the country in prison industries. And then last year, we lost 105 staff positions because of cutbacks. And in the last 2 years, we've actually gone from 23,000 inmates working in federal prison industries to 16,000 inmates working in prison industries this year,
and
a cut of 7,000 inmate positions.
What will happen to those folks when they lose those jobs?
Well, the staff, we will try, and we have always tried, if there's been modifications to prison industries, we have tried to absorb them in other areas. And so we will work to get them converted or placed into S&E bureau positions if possible. Some will move to other factories. If other factories are going to operate, they'll move some of the staff there. Some in the end may leave. Some may retire early or leave the system completely. It's just, at this point, it's hard to say since we just got the notification yesterday.
And what will it mean for the inmates who work for Unicorps? What's going to happen to those folks?
Well, what happens to the inmates is right now they can make up to about $1.20 an hour. And some people may say that that's not a great wage. But for an inmate inside a federal prison, when you work in, say, custodial cleaning, you make 12 cents an hour. And so these inmates that work in prison industries make a lot more money and are able to send that money home. They also use that money to pay their restitution and fines, which is very important to the criminal justice part of this. That money that they earn in prison industries, which is a little higher, is very helpful to them paying off the restitution to victims. And so what happens is when these inmates get laid off, they get put into other jobs in the prison, which overcrowds those places, and it really creates a difficult management situation for us with the inmate population.
And let's talk about that for a minute. From the perspective of a correctional officer, if these folks aren't working a job, what are they going to do with their time, and how does that affect, you know, the correctional officer on the front lines?
Well, this affects everything. Frankly, the more inmates we have that work in prison industry programs, the more occupied they are. Generally, they do not cause problems inside the facility, because one of the things that we use as a tool is if they have clear conduct, they get to stay in prison industries. They get to work 8 hours a day. They get to make a pretty decent wage for inside a federal prison, and that's helpful to everybody. They can buy more commissary items. They can send money home. They can buy more phone credits. There's a number of things they can do that's much better than them working in 12 cents an hour or maintenance pay positions to just keep busy. And we have seen where when we have had layoffs before with prison industries, last year, for instance, inmates actually started to argue amongst themselves who should be laid off. They started fights. We had a lot of incidents over that. And this just creates another dynamic inside an already overcrowded, underfunded prison system. This just creates another dynamic that we'll have to manage as we move forward.
And what's been the council's response to this situation?
Well, so far what we have done, our national council president, Brian Lowry, has discuss the situation with the assistant director over industries. I have, as the legislative coordinator for the council, I have forwarded all of the documentation that we received to members of the Judiciary Committee staff and to the Commerce Justice Science Committee staff. We are also going to work with other groups who are interested in inmate reentry and inmate employment, and we are going to talk to those groups and try to form some coalitions to help find a way to find other avenues of work for the inmates.
And isn't that really a huge issue? If folks are going to be coming back into the community to have a sense of work and have some job skills, I mean, this seems to be an area you really wouldn't want to cut back on.
Well, that's the thing. The inmate population in the federal system, 90 to 95% of these inmates are going to come back to a community. These are not lifers that we're talking about here. And so when these inmates come back to the community, you want them to understand how to get up and go to a job. You want them to understand how to work with a supervisor. You want them to be able to take instructions. Those kind of things they learn through this program. And there are also some marketable skills in this program. They do learn furniture operations, furniture manufacturing. They can learn cable manufacturing. We also have some service sector work, but it's on a limited basis. And so the inmate does learn to interact on a job. Some of them learn computer skills, working inside the factory on computers. And so there's a number of things that they take from this. And we certainly hope that Congress will understand that they have to come forward here. Congress will have to do something, whether it's support the program through additional appropriated funds, or they're going to have to make some modifications to allow federal prison industries to go find other job opportunities for these inmates and for the staff. The one thing we haven't really dealt with is we are talking about 140 staff positions, and you know these employees work in the local communities, pay taxes to the local community, their kids are in school there, they are part of the social fabric of those communities, and you hate to see people be uprooted because of frankly misinformation and changes made to a program that really worked at one time.
Especially in a time of recession. I know your agency's been underfunded for years. Do you guys know of any other plans by the Bureau of Prisons to eliminate services at any other BOP facilities?
As of right now, what we've been told is they are trying to come up with ways to put prison industries back in the black, so to speak. Last year, they actually we're in the red $35.7 million, and this year it's projected to be in the red $30 million. And so you can't sustain that in a non-appropriated fund operation. They pay the salaries and benefits for the staff, and they also pay the salaries for the inmates, along with purchasing raw materials and shipping of final products out to these areas. So if the income is not coming in, they just have to find ways to cut. It's like any business on the outside. They run it similar to that. There are a lot of challenges to running it. We don't automate as much as an outside business. So we're not as lean and production-oriented because our charter is to teach inmates how to work. Our charter is to re-educate and get inmates to understand how to work. So we're not as technically proficient as outside businesses. So that's where we have a real problem. And this could happen again coming into next fiscal year. If they look at the budget and they see that prison industries is going to be in the red for a third year, we'll probably see a third round of cuts. And it's just starting to be a very difficult situation inside the facility.
I want to say thank you to our guests this week, AFGE National Secretary Treasurer J. David Cox, Council of Prisons Local Legislative Coordinator Phil Glover, National Fair Practices Coordinator Michael Castile, and Vietnam Veterans of America National President John Rowan. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power.